Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the second in a three-part series exploring the birth of the Talmudic era. So about a year ago, we had a series where we looked at the birth of the rabbinic movement as a whole, and we also saw how the Mishnah and Tosefta were developed, the two original rabbinic documents. We will be recapping some core ideas from that series tonight. And what we saw last week was we began talking about the Talmudic era, and which begins in roughly 200 CE, seems to more clearly align with the actual period of the Sasanian empire that ruled Babylon during the times, beginning in 227 CE and ending in either 638 or 651, which basically spans the entire time of the Talmudic sages. What we actually spoke about last week was the lives of the sages in their wider world. And so we saw how, broadly speaking, we can divide the rabbis of Babylon into two camps: rabbis who lived in cities like Mechoza, and like Rav Nachman, like Rav, who were Mechoza was a cosmopolitan city. It was the winter capital of the Babylonian empire. Very much, if you lived in Mechoza, you were well acquainted with business, with finance, crucially with other people other than just Jews, and there was a certain cultural environment in which you lived. In contrast, one could live, for example, in Pumbedita, like Rav Yehuda, which was more of a backwater place where you were more suspicious of others. You weren't necessarily as embracive of Sasanian society. And we saw numerous examples of that tension being found amongst Chazal. And obviously, it's not just two extremes versus one another, and that's it. But actually, there was a spectrum. So the famous statement, relatively speaking, of Masechet Shabbat, the difference between Rav and Shmuel was that Rav refused to enter both the Bei Nitzrafei and the Bei Abdan, whereas Shmuel wouldn't enter the Bei Nitzrafei, but would enter the Bei Abdan, the Bei Nitzrafei being the fire temple, crucial to Zoroastrians, whereas the Bei Abdan was somewhat of an annex to the temple, where it was more of a, you know, it was still attached to a temple, but nonetheless clearly served as some sort of more cultural location. So last week we spoke about that. What I do want to talk about very briefly at the beginning, I don't have sources to this point because I want to touch on it for a few minutes, but then be done with it, which is, last week we spent a lot of time talking about the society of Chazal and their enmeshment, I think that might not really be a word, but how much they were enmeshed in their wider society. And what about Torah learning? Because, and I'd spoken about this last year, and I think I called it the George Washington problem. It could also be a term other people use, and I shamelessly stole or quoted last year. I don't remember at this point. But basically, when we think of a figure like George Washington, we end up retroactively imbuing him with the significance, the trappings of the modern president of the United States. We picture him sat in the Oval Office, despite the impossibility of that. And we picture someone who is very much an incarnation of the modern day United States president. While the truth is, obviously, it's very, very different. And that is often an issue when we learn history and terms that have, or ideas, notions, institutions that have evolved into something we still experience to this very day, but obviously back in the day were not quite the way they are now. And so it's worth discussing just briefly, what did Torah learning look like? Because, you know, nowadays one can attend a yeshiva, which is also a term that does start to crop up within the Talmudic literature, that there are yeshivot, you know, you have a Beit Midrash, and nowadays, and very much Beit Midrash is a key word within the Talmud. So what exactly is going on? So nowadays, the way kind of the yeshiva world works, broadly speaking, is yeshivot are formal institutions. They're fundamentally different from universities, but the whole point is you have an official institution with staff, with various hierarchies among those staff. You'll have a Rosh Yeshiva, you'll have what's called Ramim, which really stands for Rosh Mativta, which is actually a synonym of Rosh Yeshiva. But the point is, you have all of these various rabbis in a hierarchy, and then you have students. And those students will learn Torah as part of a structure dictated to them by the rabbi from whom they are learning. And the question becomes, how much of that, how far back has that, has the institution of the yeshiva been going? So what should be very clear, though people don't often seem to recognize this, is that prior to the 20th century, America and definitely Israel, even the greatest yeshivot of yesteryear had very small numbers. You know, when we think of some of the great yeshivot of yesteryear, if they had 80 students in them, they were huge. Contrast that with YU's, who knows how many in just, you know, in one yeshiva, and it's not the biggest. You know, yeshiva nowadays can have thousands upon thousands of students at any one time. In the 1800s, even if you had 80, it was good. So obviously there's a certain level of major change between now and then. But yeshivot as an institution really take root in the early medieval period. The rabbis who first started living after the close of the Talmudic era, so we're not going to be talking about them in this series, they really start to advance the institution of yeshivot. But what they also do is they retroactively apply their own institution to the world of the Talmud. So a Rosh Yeshiva in the 900s who was in, you know, the yeshiva of Pumbedita, even if it had moved a location physically, just like nowadays, you can go in Israel, you can go to the yeshiva of Mir or the yeshiva of Ponovich. They're in Israel, but they are named after the locations from Eastern Europe that they had originally been based. That's a very normal naming convention. So even in the medieval era, you could be a Rosh Yeshiva of Pumbedita, no longer located in historic Pumbedita. But what happens is, in the world post-Talmud, they tend to take the yeshiva institution, even then in the medieval era, and say, this was what it was like back then. But it's not really true. And fascinatingly, and there is an academic by the name of David Goodblatt, who actually did what is a classic thing, which is counting the number of occurrences of specific sets of word within the Talmud. And for the term yeshiva or mativta, which is its Aramaic translation, in the Talmud itself is mentioned fewer than 40 times. In contrast, words like Beit Midrash, Beirav so-and-so, which I'll talk about in a second, occur 419 times. In other words, Chazal didn't really talk about yeshivot. What you had was a Beit Midrash, and a Beit Midrash was maybe the most formal of all the institutions, but you basically have scholarly circles. You have, and this isn't uncommon when we think of intellectual development across humanity, you don't have a formal institution, but rather you have a certain figure known for his scholarship, known for his knowledge, finds himself a circle of students who, you know, sit at his feet and learn from him, study with him, ask him questions. Obviously, they weren't learning the Talmud because it hadn't yet been written. They were in the process of forming the statements that would go into the creation of the Talmud. And so when we think of Torah learning in the times of Chazal, it was much less, there were no institutions. What you did start to see the appearance of is what might later be called the Yarchei Kala, which is basically a public lecture to the masses. So, you know, you had the rabbi with his group of students wanting to learn from him, but then he would also lecture publicly, and the Talmud talks about this in a variety of situations, how often they had a translator or a professional, essentially projector, who would explain what the rabbi wanted to say to the masses. But that's the basic way in which Torah learning takes place. There are no formal institutions in the way we understand them. Over the passage of time, these various different schools start to coalesce, and they cease to be schools of thought and more physical schools, but that is a process that takes a long, long time. So even though we're not going to be directly talking about yeshivot in Babel or yeshivot in the land of Israel, nonetheless, it's important to have a different mental picture than I think what we are often tempted to imagine in our minds, which is to take the 21st century yeshiva and we mentally take out the electric lamps and we put candles in instead. And okay, we mentally take out the printed books and we put scrolls in instead, but we still picture the same rough institution. That's actually not the case, rather group of people around a scholar. What I want to spend the rest of the evening, most of the evening, talking about is, the birth of the Talmud. And there are two Talmuds. There is the Talmud Bavli, and there is the Talmud Yerushalmi. We are going to be focusing on the latter tonight. We are going to be focusing on the Talmud Yerushalmi. The truth is, and I'll talk more about the Talmud Yerushalmi, quite frankly, for the rest of this evening, but I'll talk a little bit more about it in just a few moments. There is no good choice over which one to introduce. Some of the things I'm kind of going to be drawing your attention to tonight will only be significant in light of what we talk about next week with the Bavli. But the problem is, once you've seen the Bavli, the Yerushalmi is kind of less exciting to see. So we're starting with the Yerushalmi so that at least we can start to appreciate some aspects of Talmudic development, because the Yerushalmi is a much less intense Talmud than the Bavli. And again, that's something that, as we talk more about how intense the Bavli is next week, that is something we will talk about far more. But the Talmud Yerushalmi, which translates literally as the Jerusalem Talmud, of all the locations in which it was produced, the one place it was definitely not produced was Jerusalem. It is often called academically the Palestinian Talmud because it was made in Roman Palestine. You can imagine how that is confusing for people nowadays. And so sometimes it's called the Talmud of the Land of Israel. Or again, convention is to keep with the idea that it's the Yerushalmi. When it was called the Yerushalmi, no one thought it was made in Yerushalayim. In Jerusalem, it's kind of like, but it stems from, theologically, the notion is it stems from post-destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, which obviously took place in Yerushalayim. That's what lends it its significance. What I want to do before turning to the Yerushalmi, though, is just recap, and it's actually going to be important to see some sources. We'll see some sources in a second, is to recap how the Mishnah and the Tosefta developed. A, because a lot of the people on this shir didn't attend the first series, because a lot of people are newcomers to the shiurim. Second, I think the shir where I explained all of this was never put up on YU Torah, so it's not even like someone could go back. And even if you did attend, quite frankly, chances are, I had to read my own notes from last time. So chances are you've forgotten too. So how did the Mishnah develop? And I touched on this a little bit last week also, just in introducing everything. But following the destruction of the Beit, what I don't want to talk about, because all of this has been recorded, is how rabbis appeared on the scene. We're just going to assume rabbis are already on the scene, not going to get into how they appeared, where they appeared, yada, yada, yada. That's, again, YU Torah, search my name. It's on there. But following the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, you can imagine that this presents a tremendous, not just theological problem, but how do you live your life as a Jew when there is no longer a temple? And it presents a couple of core challenges. Challenge number one is when a religion loses its center, it needs to, for want of a better expression, reinvent itself. When you have a religion revolving around a temple and that temple no longer exists, you have to think fast about what you're going to replace that temple with. Otherwise, it's stasis. The second problem is when you have a temple, when you have an institution, you take a lot of things for granted. If we, you know, it's an imperfect analogy, but it's a useful one. If we think back to the, you know, March 2020, when all the shuls closed, there was a certain level of all the things we took for granted that shuls just provided. A simple example, I remember in Boston having to, like every single rabbi, send out essentially a step-by-step guide on how to daven in your home on Pesach. Because even though most people maybe have a Pesach machzah at home, which has very clear instructions, the reality is people take way too for granted. You can turn up to shul, and you don't need to, no one needs to keep in their head, do we say X today? Do we not say X today? Because someone in the shul knows, It's not me, as we've learned, but someone in the shul. There's a gabbai. There's someone. The problem, by the way, and I will just say this, people who don't come to BIEV regularly, there is a question over Av Harachamim, which is said just before Ashrei, but not always said. I only say it twice a year because that's the custom of that's Minhag Anglia. That's the English custom. So I am the last person to be a resource on when you do or don't say Av Harachamim. As you saw, I double checked myself with what is even this prayer called? Because I say it twice a year. So it's not something I could tell you off by heart. So there have been a couple of occasions now in BIEV where I have been turned to as the resource of whether or not we say Av Harachamim. And I'm just like, I don't know. Or sometimes I'll confidently declare something and it turns out it's wrong. So that's why we have Gabbai. But the point is, if you think about that small example, people are used to turning up to shul and the shul tells you what to do. The shul tells you how to live your Jewish life. We take those kinds of things for granted. Now imagine, instead of a shul, you have a temple and that temple's just been ransacked by your oppressors. So that really destroys anyone's ability to live a Jewish life. Now, the analogy I think I'd used last time was, you know, baseball fans, all of a sudden, basically everything baseball has been destroyed. And it's up to the last remaining fans to reconstruct the rules of the game and rebuild it. It's that kind of idea. That's the challenge facing Chazal. And something else that I'd mentioned last week was that you start to see very quickly Jews are using the Roman legal system. That tends to happen in the ancient world. When you get conquered, you just kind of assimilate into your enemies. This is, you know, the whole thing with the lost 10 tribes. The lost 10 tribes are truly lost because they would have assimilated within just a few short generations, because that's what you did in the ancient world. And so the early rabbis were faced with a challenge, which is to bring some sort of definition to Jewish life. And so at first, this was all happening purely, not just orally, but again, through rabbis being presences within their various communities across generations, kind of having certain viewpoints that maybe differed with one another. But what happens around 200 CE, Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, he basically orally redacts the Mishnah. And the Mishnah is in some ways a very quick and dirty book on how to live a Jewish life. And at this point, I will already share the screen. And the first two sources from tonight are shamelessly copied and pasted from last year's share on the Mishnah and Tosefta because we're recapping. So you can always see how my transliteration conventions, you know, change whichever direction the wind is blowing. So we have some interesting transliteration conventions going on here as opposed to sometimes other times. But if we take, for example, and this is going to be our example, the very first Mishnah of the sixth chapter of Masechet Brachot. It says the following, Ketzad mevarachin al ha-peirot. What bracha does one make on fruits? Al peirot ha-ilan, fruits of the tree. Omer borei pri ha-eitz, chutz min ha-yayin, except wine. Sha'al ha-yayin omer, on wine you say borei pri ha-gofen. Va'al peirot ha-aretz aimer, and on fruit of the land you say borei pri ha-adama. Chutz min hapat, except for bread. Sha'al hapat hu omer hamotzi lechem min ha'aretz. Va'al hayurakot omer borei pri ha'adama. On vegetables, you say the bracha of ha'adama. Rabbi Yehuda omer borei minei desha'im. So what we have, I'm not bothering to translate the names of brachot because the names of the brachot, the words of the brachot are less important than the actual types. What we have here is one of the most wonderfully constructed mishnayot ever. All foods are folded into conceptual categories. Everything is fruit, in a sense. Everything is produce. And, you know, there's produce of trees, which divides into fruits and wine. We have produce of the land, which divides basically into perhaps other forms of fruits, vegetables, and also bread, which technically is produce of the land when you think about it. Great, wonderful. We do have debate preserved within this Mishnah. Most of this Mishnah just states things declaratively. This is how things are. This is the law. There you go. Boom. But it does record a dissenting opinion of Rabbi Yehuda, who was himself a prominent rabbi of the fourth generation, who actually disagreed. And this is basically the Mishnah. It's preserving. It's already creating a code by which to live. It's a handy guide. You could use this. in the ancient world to navigate most of the foods that you are eating. However, there are many problems. First of all, there are two brachot that we say nowadays frequently that didn't even make it onto this list. One, Boreimine Mizonot, and the second being Shahakol Niebidvara, which are absent from this Mishnah. And a really good way of kind of expressing the flaw in this Mishnah is it is so tight in its construction that it does not help clarify edge cases. What if you have a cookie? What is the bracha according to this? A cookie is neither bread nor necessarily completely the produce of the land. What do you do? What bracha do you make? This Mishnah does not give us any sort of clue as to what we should do. And so there are flaws to this Mishnah. In addition to the Mishnah, which was the main document, the most authoritative document produced by the Tanoim, the rabbis who lived 0 through 200 CE, the rabbis of the Mishnah, was also produced the Tosefta. I don't want to talk about the Tosefta in any detail whatsoever. I do want to draw your attention to a couple of important points it makes nonetheless. But the Tosefta is about three times the size of the Mishnah. It is far more expansive. It includes far more debate. And this Tosefta here, which is also a product of the Mishnaic era, starts to complicate things quite a bit. So if we take a look at Halachot 6 and 7, and this is what I want to focus on, we read Hakoseis et Hachitid, one who is chewing wheat, was a snack back in the day, Mavarech Alehem Boreimine Zeraim, there's a special bracha here to be made, Off on Bashlan, Imhayu Prusot Kayamot, if you baked it or cooked it, if the pieces are recognizable, Mevarich Alein Hamotzi Lechem in Haaretz, make the bracha of Hamotzi, Ein HaPrusot Kayamot, if they're not recognizable, Mevarich Alein Boreimine Mezonot, ding ding ding, we have the appearance of Eki Bracha Boreimine Mezonot, and Halacha 7 repeats the same thing, chewing Orez, Orez is I'm not sure if rice existed in those days, whatever Orez actually is. But the point is, one who chews this thing, again, the Tosefta introduces, it complicates the Mishnah. And so we conclude the Tanaic period, roughly 200 CE, with these very handy-dandy, orally preserved documents. We have the Mishnah, which is tight and authoritative. And then we have the Tosefta, which is slightly more expansive, very much in the vein of the Mishnah. Now along comes 200 CE. And again, there are the rabbis who live in Babylon. We're going to put them aside and talk about them next week. But now we have the rabbis living in the land of Israel. And for both rabbis living in Babylon and living in the land of Israel, the term for the rabbis who lived from 200 through 400 CE are called Amoraim. If Tanoim literally means the teachers, Amoraim means the statement makers, which is going to be important, and it's going to be very obvious why we call them the statement makers very soon. The Yerushalmi is completed roughly 400 CE, obviously not literally 400 CE, but roughly 400 CE. The Bavli will not be completed for another 200 years, 600 CE. Again, what happens in those 200 years? Next week, it's going to be a lot of fun, but lots still happens in 200 to 400 CE. And that's what we're talking about this week. The point of the Talmuds, in a nutshell, is to be a commentary on the Mishnah. And that's an awful, awful description of the Bavli, as we'll touch on next week. The Talmud Bavli, the Babylonian Talmud as a commentary on the Mishnah, is literally captures about maybe 40% of it at best. The Yerushalmi, it's a better description. The Yerushalmi's goal is to expand on the Mishnah. So again, we've seen the Tosefta, but put the Tosefta to the back of your minds. We look once again at this Mishnah. And you are a rabbi now living in the land of Israel, circa 200 through 400 CE. And the problem is you now have a group of people around you wanting to live a life according to Jewish law. And they're bringing you a variety of foods that this, and you know, you're teaching them the Mishnah, great, but then there's always that one person. There has always been that one person who's like, I have this food. It does not match any of the categories you described. And that is that person exists this very day. Every single Jewish community has the decategorizers, and they point out often flaws in the system, in the way we kind of think rabbinically. The Mishnah in Brachot is very, very useful, but, and I'm about to use a disrespectful word, but I'm using it somewhat in jest, but it kind of sucks. It's a little bit not too useful with these edge cases. Enter the Amoraim. What the Amoraim are going to do is they are going to seek to flesh out this Mishnah. And so what the Yerushalmi's main goal is to do, and it does this so, so faithfully, is to expand the details of the Mishnah as tersely as possible, as simply as possible. And the way it does this, and we're going to see this in a second with an explicit example building off the Mishnah we already learned, the first thing the Yerushalmi looks to do, and again, right now, this is going to sound common sense, but trust me, when we talk about the Bavli next week, then you'll realize this is actually a very unique position of the Yerushalmi. The first thing the Yerushalmi is always going to do is turn to the Tosefta. Makes a lot of sense. Tosefta, I already said, expands the Mishnah. So the Yerushalmi is going to take the Tosefta, but then the Yerushalmi is going to introduce to us to additional, more complicated statements. So with all that, and I'm zooming out now. So you might have noticed in the top left of the screen share, you can see this is page 1 of 8 of the sources. Don't worry, there aren't 7 more pages of sources that we are going to be reading, because however long it took to prepare this share, it just took as long to Photoshop, because prepare yourselves. I hope everyone is sitting down for the graphic journey that we're all about to, the graphic design journey we're all about to go on. But the very first thing I'm showing you, and I'm trying to zoom out, is a page of Yerushalmi. Next week, when we talk about the Bavli, I'll dwell more on the actual shape and design of the page. The Yerushalmi nowadays basically is designed to look like the Bavli. So this is kind of, if you were to buy a Yerushalmi off the shelf, that you'd open it up, this would be basically what pages look like. There's actually 2 pages that are relevant to our discussion. These are those 2 pages. The first thing I did is I stripped away all the unnecessary for our purposes. So now what these pages are the actual discussion on our Mishnah. So just to kind of, and I'm going to speed now on the Zoom, so I apologize if this gives someone motion sickness. So this is our Mishnah. I believe now with perfect faith that people can see my mouse when I wave it wildly on the screen. This is the Mishnah, a short amount of text. And the amount of commentary that it produces, it's not actually true. It produces a lot more commentary than this, but the core thing it's going to produce is this amount. So you can already see we've increased significantly the word count that has been produced by this Mishnah. But now what I actually want to turn to, the page I want to turn to now, is this one. Because you will, by the way, there's no English because, as it's going to be very clear, most of the English you've already seen to a lot of these words. And I think it is far more valuable to feel, to see the physical, to feel like this is the actual text. And again, because the words, understanding each and every word is less important than the ideas being conveyed by the image almost. So that's why I kind of did it this way. I departed from my usual Hebrew English because I wanted to get the sense of this is the visual of the text. So you'll notice there are some gaps in the text from what you'd previously seen. We will come back to those. But for now, let's take a look at what the Yerushalmi says, commenting on our Mishnah. The very first thing we read in the Yerushalmi is Hakoses et Hachitin, one who chews wheat, Omer Alav, Borei Minei Zeronim. You make the bracha of Borei Minei Zeronim. Afyan Uvashlan. If you bake it or cook it. Bizman Shaprusot Kayamot. If the pieces are discernible. Omer Aleihen Hamotzi Lechem Min Haaretz. This is hopefully sounding familiar. Umavarech La'acharav Shalosh Brachot. And you make afterwards three brachot, which is Al HaMechet. Which is benching. Im ein haprusot kayamot, if the pieces are not discernible, omer alehem borei minei mezonot, then you make the bracha of mezonot, umavarech acharav bracha achat mein shalosh, that's al hamechil, that's what you say afterwards. And then the next thing we read, hakoseis et haorez, one who chews orez, omer alav borei minei zaronim, Af av ubashlav, you bake it, you cook it. Af al pisha prusot kayamot, omer alav borei minei mezanot, ve'in tzarech acharav levarech, you make the bracha of borei minei mezanot, and there's no need to say anything afterwards. That's it. That is the bulk, but that is a core amount of the Yerushalmi. It's just the Tosefta. Now again, going back to how I kind of introduced all of this, this is not going to be astonishing until next week. But just bear in mind that Yerushalmi, without any fanfare, without anything, just brought in the Tosefta. So again, we read the Mishnah, rapid scroll, zoom in a second. We read the Mishnah, which gave us an architecture for thinking of the various brachot that go with various foods. And then the Tosefta exists, and the Tosefta adds a few more brachot, complicates things slightly. A couple of the brachot, it should be noted, the language is slightly changed, but that's not important for our purposes. And what we saw was that the very first thing the Yerushalmi does is bring in the Tosefta. Wonderful. Now, everything we have seen thus far is Tanoic. Is from the statements of the rabbis, teachings of the rabbis, 0 through 200 CE. We've seen the Mishnah, we've seen the Tosefta, and we've seen the Tosefta just printed as part of the Yerushalmi. Where do the Amoraim come in? And again, bear this in mind, and just I'll be drawing your attention back to this next week. Where do the Amoraim come in? Here. Ignore the green for a second, pretend the green is red. But the Amoraim are going to do something very simple here. They are going to continue the project of the Mishnah and the Tosefta by, in a sense, more the Tosefta than the Mishnah. We assume the Tosefta to be in part a rival to the Mishnah, but in part a commentary to the Mishnah. The Amoraim are going to continue this project by expanding the cases in the Mishnah and by refining and complicating slightly the discussion. So the first thing that we read after that first Tosefta, which teaches us an important distinction between whether the pieces of the grain are discernible or not. And based on how discernible they are, that dictates the bracha you get. This obviously opens up a question, which is, well, what does that mean? Imagine the scenario. You are trying to use the Tosefta to guide what bracha you make. And now you have a certain thing, you're holding a certain item of food in front of you. And you're like, I can't actually tell if the pieces are truly discernible or not. They kind of look discernible, but not too discernible. And you bring it to your rabbi. And you're like, Rabbi, tell me what to do. And this is exactly what the Amoraim are doing. So the Yerushalmi then asks, in the green, ad kama yehu prasot. What size are we talking about when we say discernible or not? And we have the view of the first Amora to be quoted in our little section, Rav Yossi Berebi Avun, Kahana Bar Malkia B'Shem Rav. So it's actually two different figures here, quoting the name of Rav. Ad Kazetim, the size of olive-sized bits. This is not a practical halacha shiur. We don't need to worry too much about exactly what it means. But the point is that if you can, if it's discernible to the point that it, you know, it's chunky to the size of an olive, that we consider to be discernible. Great. So, you know, you could imagine that line being added to the Mishnah. That line does not look, that statement of Rabbi Yossi Rabbi Abun or Kahana Bar Malkia does not look out of place in the Mishnah. It's just, it just was said hundreds of years later, or at least within 200 years. And then the Yerushalmi is going to say more on Hakoses et Ha'orez. One who chews Orez, we have a different brachot depending on the process once again. So we were taught that you make a bracha of either Boremine Zeronim or Boremine Mezonot. That was the ruling of the Tosefta. And now the Yerushalmi is going to bring some complicating statements. Rabbi Yirmiyah Amar. We're over here now. Rabbi Yirmiyah Amar. Bore Pri Ha'adama. He says that you actually make the bracha of Bore Pri Ha'adama. Bar Marena Barich Kumi Rav Zera Vekumi Rebbe Chia Bar Abba Bar Va. So this rabbi by the name of Bar Marena. So now we get it. We actually start to get something that, I mean, you actually still find this in the Mishnah. Actually, it's not unique to the Talmuds. I correct myself before I said the statement. So whatever. A bracha was recited before these two other prestigious rabbis. What was that bracha? Shahakol Nihya Bidvaro. Which is the final bracha that we are familiar with, making its appearance as an Amoraic invention, as an Amoraic innovation, that there was a bracha that this rabbi would say under certain situations in front of other rabbis. In other words, he wasn't ashamed to use this bracha. They accepted this bracha. There you go. Rabbi Shimon Chasida Omer Borei Minei Ma'adonim. Rabbi Shimon Chasida says that the bracha is Borei Minei Ma'adonim. So what we have here from the Yerushalmi is three different rabbis adding three different alternative brachot. One says in basically the same case. So the Tosefta had said, Hakoseis et Ha'orez, you say Borei Minei Zeronim. And ostensibly, this is what it's commenting on, I'd guess. That no, Rabbi Yirmiyah says you make Ha'adama. Bar Marina says you make Sha'akol Nei Abedvara. Rav Shimon Chasida says Borei Minei Ma'adonim. Here is an interesting question to ask, which I think often gets people when learning either Talmud. Are Rav Yirmiyah Bar Marina and Rav Shimon Chasida in the same room when this discussion is taking place? The answer is emphatically no, because they lived in different generations. They didn't live at the same time. And this is a hallmark of both Talmuds, creating this sense that everyone's in the room debating one another. This isn't actually a debate between Rav Yirmiyah Bar Marina and Rav Shimon Chasida. This was, and this again goes back to what we talked about in the times of the Mishnah too. There were these rabbis, and these rabbis are known to the editor of the Yerushalmi. We'll talk about that more soon. These opinions have been recorded, have been preserved throughout a couple of centuries. These respected rabbis all had different opinions. It's like nowadays. Nowadays, we are familiar with this idea still, that, can you do X during Sfirat HaOmer? Rabbi X says yes. Rabbi Y says no. Rabbi Z says sometimes. And the way sometimes this is presented when rabbis are giving shiurim is, again, we ignore the fact that these rabbis might actually have lived in different times. I can be talking in the shul about Rashi and Ramban and acting as though the two interacted with each other, whereas it was very much a one-way interaction because Rashi was dead long before Ramban stepped onto the scene. The Yerushalmi does this too. This is what we might call an artificial debate. It's not particularly significant because the debate isn't so strong, but particularly, again, this comes up a lot more in the Bavli, where you sometimes have to be checking whether this debate is taking place in person, which is plausible sometimes. If you have two rabbis who lived in the same town during the same generation, they can be discussing with one another. And again, we know Bar Morena is living around the same period as Rabbi Chia, Barva and Rav Zeira, because he's before them. And that's like a precedent. The Yerushalmi is recording a precedent there. It was known that Bar Morena stood before these other rabbis at this time in their presence, and he made the bracha of Shakol, but Rav Shimon Chasida and Rav Yirmiya not in the same generations. But fine, we have nonetheless essentially a debate being recorded. The next thing that we read is the following. A crucial, crucial line, not so much for now, but because, you know what I'm going to say, next week this line is going to have a lot of resonance. Amar Rabbi Yossi, Berebi Abun, Velo Pligi. These opinions don't actually disagree. And it's very clear from the continuation of the Yerushalmi, they're actually debating the bracha of Borei Minei Mezonot, as we're about to see. But Rav Yossi Berebi Abun says, the Yerushalmi just presented four different opinions as to the bracha one makes. Mezonot, Ha'adama, Shehakol, and Borei Minei Ma'adonim. And Rabbi Yossi Berebi Abun is coming along after all four of these opinions have been known on the record, and he's saying they don't disagree with one another. Man damar boremine mezonot. The one who says you say a boremine mezonot, bahahu da avid bull. It's when you're eating it as a block. Man damar bore priha adama. One who says you make the bracha of bore priha adama, bahahu devrir, is when it's distinct, when the pieces are fundamentally distinct. Man damar. Shehakol niya bidvaro, the one who says you make the bracha of shehakol, is saying bahahid the shaluk is when it was cooked extensively. Uman da amar boremine ma'adamim, bahahud the taruf. The one who says you make the bracha of boremine ma'adamim, it's when it was jellied. In other words, what we read as four different opinions on the bracha one makes on a particular item, along comes Rabbi Yossi Berebi Abun and says all these rabbis weren't disagreeing with one another. They weren't having different opinions. Rather, they were saying that depending on the form that the item takes, that actually dictates its bracha. What we have here is something that will become incredibly characteristic of the Bavli, even more so, which is harmonizing disagreement. Rabbis in the Talmudic era do not like disagreement. They record a lot of disagreement, but one of the biggest goals of the Talmudic project is to harmonize disagreement. It's not that Rabbi X and Rabbi Y thought that each other were wrong. It's not that Rabbi X did something wrong in the eyes of Rabbi Y, but rather, Rabbi X's actions were prompted by a different set of realities to Rabbi Y's. And again, this is going to be an idea that's going to be far more significant when we encounter the Bavli. But the main thing we see from the Yerushalmi is merely continuing and to flesh out the Mishnah. That was what Amoraim did. The Amoraim, be they in the land of Israel, or be they living in Babylon, be they living in Bavel, what the Amoraim did was just continued adding statements to the Mishnah. adding a few more cases, adding a few more examples, adding a few more of this and that. If we actually look even closer for a second at this Yerushalmi, it says Rav Yirmiya Amar, Rav Yirmiya said, Rav Shimon Chasida Omer, Rav Shimon Chasida said, that Amoraim, they speak. The actual middle one, Bar Morena, is actually more recording a situation that happened. He's not actually explicitly stating it, but nonetheless, his opinion has been recorded. And that is important for a point I'll get to in a second. But the key innovation of the Amoraim, regardless of where they lived, was adding statements to the Mishnah, adding levels to it, adding further complications and situations. There is one other thing that we see here in this Yerushalmi, and that's the words in green. Because when you think about it for a second, the words in green are doing a lot of heavy lifting. The words in green, ad kama yehu prusot, for what does it mean for them to be distinct? How distinct do they need to be? If we didn't have those words in there, we would go from the Tosefta talking about the brachot one makes when depending on whether something is distinct or not, to Rabbi Yossi Rabbi Abun's statement or Kahana Bar Malkia's statement in the name of Rav, that of what specifically it needs to look like to be distinct. The green is an editorialization. The green is the words of an editor helping contextualize the statement of Rabbi Yossi Barabbi Abba or Kahana Bar Malkia. The Yerushalmi, and oh boy, are we going to need to talk about this next week when we talk about the Bavli, had editors. It was the rabbis who actually took the statements of the Amoraim and put them together. What the editor does is they take the relevant statements of Rav Yirmiya, the actions of Bar Malkia, and the statement of Rav Shimon Chasida relating to the bracha one makes on Orez, and puts them all next to one another as a debate. And then takes the statement of Rabbi Yossi Rabbi Abun and places that after them. That's what the editor, and then what the editor does is gives a helpful little line to frame and contextualize the statements we are reading when they're not otherwise relevant. If you've ever picked up, say, an art scroll Gemara, the art scroll Gemara will sometimes say, Karen, do this too. The Gemara says. Now, the Gemara is obviously not an independent entity. When Oscar used the term the Gemara, and Karen used the term the Gemara says, what they actually mean is the editor stuck this in there. The editors are not named. They don't take credit for themselves, but they just arranged the whole thing. And as I stop the screen share at this point, the role of an editor is going to be crucial and game-changing. Next week, when we get to the Bavli, I'll just say we're going to be seeing a lot more green. The role of the editor is crucial. But the main idea we extract from the Yerushalmi is the role of the Amoraim. That following the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, we had the creation of the Mishnah, the creation of the Tosefta, but the project still wasn't done. There were way too many edge cases, way too many additional considerations that needed to be figured out. And so you have another 200 years, essentially, of rabbis further complicating the ideas found within the Mishnah, introducing and teaching the words of the Tosefta that were then taken by anonymous editors of the Yerushalmi and placed into the Yerushalmi, placed into one handy, though much larger place to find all of these things to be preserved. And I've mentioned this before in other shiurim, we actually don't have all of the Yerushalmi because the Yerushalmi has always been the lesser sibling to the Bavli. And so we actually didn't bother to preserve it. The Jews didn't bother to preserve all of the Yerushalmi anyway. So we actually don't have it. And even though it definitely existed on, you know, far more than the Bavli did. But the key thing is the role of the Amorai, complicating the Mishnah, adding additional information that otherwise we would be lost without. And it's this little role of the editor in the Yerushalmi. The Yerushalmi has the editorial hand is so light, but recognizing the fact that I'm drawing your attention to that so much is setting up what we will talk about next week as we grapple with and understand what on earth the Babylonian Talmud is and how it came to become the unique beast that it is and the defining work of the Jewish world.